I'm Luke Cooper, and this is Counterpower, the podcast for global solidarity. It's been 10 long years since the EU referendum. Britain sits outside the European Union. The Conservative Party has been badly broken, perhaps even beyond repair, by its inability to turn the Brexit vision into a workable reality. And the biggest beneficiaries of the Brexit culture wars have been a resurgent far right, from Nigel Farage's Reform to Tommy Robinson's mass movement. They're still not in power, but it can often feel like they dominate the political agenda, with this Labour government in particular going far further than even the Conservatives ever proposed in their attempts to out-reform reform. Brexit's hugely successful slogan was, of course, take back control. But what exactly did it mean? For some, it was about a Westminster all too distant and out of touch. For others, it was immigration. But for Kojo Karam, our guest on today's show, it was about something else. Brexiteers wanted to restore a lost sense of control over the rest of the world, the kind that Britain enjoyed in the age of empire. And this, more than anything else, explains why the project failed. There is simply no going back to this bygone age. So to talk all of this through, I'm also delighted to be joined in the virtual studio by Elena Ivanova from the Another Europe is Possible campaign that has been fighting the politics of Brexit for more than a decade. And in part two, we'll also be giving you a sneak preview of Kojo's forthcoming book, The Next Fix, The Story of the War on Drugs. And you might be surprised just how relevant it is to the failed colonial politics of Brexit. So Kojo, welcome to the show. Great to see you, and great to see you also, Elena. So Kojo, let's start with you. How are you planning to mark the Brexit anniversary? I have you down as a bit of a bunting-like guy, maybe a bit of a street party celebration, or any other plans?
Oh, well, maybe you might have caught some video of me singing Tales to Albion's Rule Britannia. If you do see those, that wasn't me. That was all AI. But in reality, I think that we can make light of it, but this is such a serious marker of a pivot in the direction of the United Kingdom. For me, it is really dystopian to see the same political configurations and obviously the very same figurehead and someone like Nigel Farage now being on the precipice of being politically rewarded in terms of the rise of reform and their potential elevation to government. He's on the precipice of being rewarded for a lot of the social fracturing and economic catastrophe that have been visited upon the country by the very initiative that he used to propel himself onto the national stage. And there does seem to be a real bitter irony in that everyone, whether it's students, whether it's manual laborers, whether it's communities that relied on that proximity relationship to Europe, whether it's fishermen, so many people have seen their living standards worsened by Brexit. And the person whose living standards have been most improved, very much so when he receives $5 million donation from crypto billionaires, although we might say a few more about that. He doesn't like to talk about that or have other people talk about it. But the one person whose situation has markedly been improved by it is Nigel Farage and a lot of the political opportunists who have ridden on the back of the hostility that I think has been really crystallized by the post-Brexit era of British politics.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're already getting into it. It's great. But yeah, Elena, what are you doing to mark the Brexit anniversary? Apart from putting out the Another Europe is Possible statement, of course.
Yes, yeah, sure.
And
yeah.
What is the Brexit anniversary in Scotland like right now, actually? Scotland was for a long time after the Brexit referendum seen as this pro-Remain, pro-EU outlier in the UK. But now, of course, you do have a reform presence in Scotland. And I think that changes the mix a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's really interesting. This is actually something I am looking forward to in terms of seeing how the anniversary lands here in Scotland, seeing some of the analysis and the news output around it and what people will be saying about Brexit. I think for the last 10 years, and definitely for the last 5 years since I've moved to Scotland, Brexit has always been spoken of as this very clear-cut case in point why Scotland should be independent, as this self-fulfilling prophecy about the breakdown of the United Kingdom in a way. So it's a different mix of powers and political actors up here now, with Reform doing relatively well in the Scottish elections and getting a lot of regional list seats. So there will be more voices, I think, this time around speaking about the anniversary, and there will be a bit more of a nuanced view, even in Scotland. In terms of how I'm going to mark the anniversary, yes, I'll do some work. I'll do some Another Europe is Possible work around messaging about the anniversary. But also we're gathering our forces and our thinking and our arguments, looking forward to the next 10 years and what are the arguments that we need to be making now that a lot of the predictions around what Brexit would mean and who it will usher into power are coming true. So this is very much a moment to gather our allies and think about what comes next and what's the next chapter. So we're doing that within Another Europe. Personally, I'll probably just, have a stiff drink on the night and think about what a wild ride the last 10 years have been.
Sounds about right. And so Kojo, like, we've already in a way started getting into this, right? I think one of the interesting things about Reform's politics is that I'm not sure if they're that interested in talking about Brexit that much anymore, right? When forced, they will say it's wonderful and they will say we haven't seized the opportunities of Brexit, etc. But in a way, their gaze has shifted a lot towards this anti-immigration, stop the boats, and a quite hardline ethno-nationalism. I think you would argue that was quite a predictable trajectory, right? In the sense that I think part of your argument is that this is a colonial vision of the UK's place in the world in an international order today where that's not going to work in the way that it once did. And I was wondering if you could flesh that out for me. Why did you argue that Brexit was this colonial imaginary project? And do you think that argument has stood the test of time today?
Yeah, such a great question, Luke. And just before I talk about the kind of colonial underpinnings of the kind of Brexit rhetoric, I think it really is important just to sit with how little Reform have been confronted with the reality of the Brexit decision, particularly by the British media, as they've been guilted this ascent into power. I think that this should be on every single time they're in the media, every time they're on Question Time, which is a lot. They should be asked, hang on a second, these are the promises the senior figures in your party said around Brexit of what it would deliver to the United Kingdom, and it has not done that. How do you account for that, and how do you explain to the public why they should invest faith in you again in order to enact a whole set of changes? Now it's removal of indefinite leave to remain or much more stringent immigration policies. What was Farage's one recently? Not allowing anybody who was born overseas to be able to access social housing. Will these policies materially improve people's lives? That should be put in the context of the last big promise Farage gave the British public, not improving their life in any single sustainable metric. And so I think that the British media have really done a poor job of making Farage particularly account for the promises he made around Brexit. And I think that absolutely it was inevitable. First of all, this, I wouldn't consider it a massive divergence from the rhetoric that underpinned the Brexit moment. This anti-immigration, we always remember the pictures that depicted these brown hordes coming over the seas. There was so much about the debate around Britain's membership of the EU that became a proxy for not just migration, but a particular nostalgic vision of what Britain was, which for me, I mentioned always, was myopic in terms of blinding itself to the much broader colonial architecture that made Britain the hegemonic power of the world in the 19th century and a little bit in the early part of the 20th century. And for me, it wasn't simply that this was of a confused understanding of Britain's relationship in this new, highly hostile, protectionist, multipolar world, for us to still assume that we have a bit of gumblow diplomacy to the natives. People might famously remember the trade policy, the post-Brexit trade policy, being nicknamed by civil servants, a little bit mockingly, being nicknamed Empire 2.0. This idea that we're going to go to India and Nigeria and all these emerging economic and geopolitical powers and be like, aren't you so glad to like re-enter into the structure of empire? And they're like, things have changed, mate. That was one element of it. But I think the bigger element was the blindness to the way in which the colonial architecture of the British state itself was driving so much of the inequality and so much of the erosion of living standards of everyday British people, which was then redirected and towards hostility towards the European Union, and now hostility towards this kind of phantom idea of migrants, despite very small boats coming over. These images have become the explanation for why the life of everyday British people gets worse on worse generation after generation. And I think that resentment is legitimate and is real. People can look around and be like, hang on a second, the library's closed, the Shore Star Centre's closed, the divergence between wages and the actual cost of assets, key assets like housing, have gone in completely polar directions. Everything seems to be getting more unaffordable year on year. This idea of something is going wrong, the slogan of Brexit was such an intelligent one where it said, take back control. This idea that people do feel very viscerally, I'm losing something, I'm losing some sort of control. But I think that the value of understanding Britain's imperial history is understanding that the cause of that erosion of control isn't the brown person who might live next door to you, but it's the fact that, to draw upon one of the great Scottish thinkers of the 20th and 21st century, Tom Nairn, his idea was that the British state is still an imperial feudalist state in terms of its landlords, in terms of its constitutional or non-constitutional laws, in terms of its economic structure. So much of it is still tied towards the unproductive nature of colonial wealth accumulation, which is rentierism, which is suppression of surplus populations, that this is still visited even in the now abandoned post-industrial Red Wall, after it was practiced and sharpened and turned into an acute method of wealth extraction in the colonies over the course of the 20th century. And so I think that connection, and that's what I tried to do with the book on Commonwealth, was to, in very simple terms, look at some of the companies that really profited from British imperialism, your Anglo-Iranian oil companies, and then fast forward to the energy crisis in Britain in the 2020s, where the Anglo-Iranian oil company, which didn't disappear into thin air, became British Petroleum, then BP, is still extracting huge profits whilst everyday people struggle to be able to choose between heating their home or feeding their children. If you want to understand the roots of so much of Britain's modern political, economic, and social crisis, I think you have to go back to that 400-year history of empire and what so much of Brexit and now the immigration debate about reform does is try and direct that interrogation elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at its core for me, what Brexit really lacked is a coherent vision for what the UK in its present state should be doing internationally. And I think one of the things that comes up, you mentioned Empire 2.0. Of course, the other big idea that was promoted very heavily by right-wing outliers during the Boris Johnson government, and Johnson made a pretty serious attempt to try to negotiate it, was, of course, the American trade deal. And that American trade deal would have meant a destruction of our agricultural and food standards, probably the end of UK farming. It would potentially open up the NHS to further privatisation. All things that would not be helpful for any British citizen, let's say, also all extremely unpopular.
And what would that mean politically? I mean, to some extent, that would mean attachment, further attachment to an American empire, not a kind of empire 2.0 global Britain, as it was called. So it was full of those kinds of contradictions. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, actually, is that one of the responses that's sometimes made to your kind of argument is that this isn't, or Brexit wasn't fundamentally about a colonial narrative, but it was really just raw nationalism. It was quite inward looking. And I thought I'd give you a chance to respond to that in a way, especially as you mentioned Tom Nairn, one of the famous theorists of what nationalism is. For you, how would you explain the relationship between nationalism and empire?
I mean, I think that this takes on different configurations across different contexts of different countries, have that relationship between the colonial era and the kind of standard bourgeois Western nation state format that people are, you know, considered to be the kind of norm of state sovereignty in the 21st century. But I think that Nairn is someone who's so useful for understanding the extent to which this blurs in the UK project, you know, with his idea of, you know, Britain has never been a nation state. And that sounds hyperbolic and sounds provocative, and I'm sure it was phrased in order to invite that. But he, you know, looks at the process through which, you know, the kind of post French Revolution restructuring of the democratic nation state across liberal capitalist lines functioned, you know, across North America and Western Europe. And so much of the United Kingdom failed to go through that same process. You know, we didn't even have a separation between the legislature and the judiciary until, you know, very recently with the House of Lords, you know, then giving way to the Supreme Court. And so, you know, basic kind of separations of powers, basic ideas of a distinction between church and state, you know, the fact that the head of state is also the head of the Church of England, basic ideas around, you know, the relationship between the state and land. People can look at, only now we're starting to pay attention to the fact that we still have this, at least in England and Wales and Scotland, you've been able to extract yourself from this, but in England and Wales, you've still got, you know, the feudal leasehold system where you can own your property but continue to pay rent ad infinitum to a potentially obscured landlord. You know, the fact that the British jurisdiction, even in 2026, still isn't confined to this island nation that Michael Gove promised us. And that was a lot of the other parts of Uncommonwealth as well, where I was like, you know, we want to talk about things like tax avoidance. You know, now in the subsequent years since the book came out and since Brexit, we've had a big reemergence of the conversation around a potential wealth tax, you know, led by, you know, Gary Stevenson, you know, Faisal Shaheen, a lot of people doing amazing work on that. But you also need to think about, well, how would we implement a wealth tax in a country in which we still have multiple jurisdictions that are the leading offshore tax havens in the world? Because we forget that Britain isn't confined to this little North Atlantic island that we see on the world. The Cayman Islands, the British Virgin Islands, Bermuda, we talk about these places when they come up in the news, like they're these bizarre, nefarious Caribbean islands, you know, oh, the Cayman Islands, you know, who knows what tricky things those Caribbeans are doing over there. This is Britain. This is British territory. Their ultimate sovereignty continues to reside under Westminster. And if you want an example of how British overseas territories are still actually part of Britain, ask the same people who don't want to talk about the Cayman Islands about the Chagos Islands. Oh, you talk about the Chagos Islands, they'll tell you very much that is Britain, and Keir Starmer trying to facilitate the return back to Mauritius is treason and treachery. But if you want to talk about ideas of the Cayman Islands or the BVI, no, they're these bizarre Caribbean tax havens. What could anybody in Britain do about those? And so to understand how the structure of Britain continues to be informed by its colonial architecture, I think for me really speaks to some of the material basis behind the ideological rhetoric of nationalism in places like the United Kingdom. There is a difference between the kind of cultural experience of togetherness of, you know, the David Goodhart being, you know, the somewheres versus the anywheres, this idea of place that nation wants to invoke in Britain. And that is very real. And that for me is why so much of the kind of resurgence of interest in the topic around empire was very quickly and cleverly diverted into conversations around culture and nationhood, around Churchill, around what statues are in our public square, around, you know, do you feel proud when you sing Land of Hope and Glory? Should we sing it at the national proms? All of these conversations around the cultural expressions of nationhood, and very little conversations about the material architecture of empire, because people don't want to talk about the legacy of the colonial companies that profited so much through empire and the role they continue to play in the contemporary economy. People don't want to talk about the way that Britain's former colonies, and we now call them overseas territories, continue to facilitate this offshore architecture that makes the insulation of wealth, you know, such, you know, there's a reason why all those Russian billionaires decided to base themselves in Britain. It's not just because they really loved Chelsea Football Club and the Premier League. It's because of its access towards the City of London, the financiers, and the pathway towards the kind of elite offshore kind of territory in terms of wealth insulation. And so for me, the colonial structure of Britain is something that you really need to understand if you want to understand some of the tensions that continue to challenge the actual nation in itself, even up until today.
Yeah, fantastic. And there was a really interesting article today in The Observer, I can put it in the show notes, that highlighted the role of Bermuda and the British Virgin Islands in particular as a conduit for Russian sanctions circumvention. And you're thinking, these are, as you say, British territories, and Britain geopolitically is supposedly aligned, and we are aligned. We're putting a lot of military and financial aid into Ukraine in one way or another. And why on earth are Russian oligarchs able to get around sanctions through British colonial territories? And it really is stunning that that is going on. And I know in the run-in to the G20 in 2027, I think campaigners, and I know you'll be doing this, will be like absolutely trying to make money and offshore finance a critical question for that G20, because you can't have democratic public interest and politics unless we tackle this issue. And Britain in particular is really well placed to do it, actually, and to play a positive role in tackling all of those issues. So Elena, let's win to respond. I was just thinking, like, when Kojo was talking then, in some ways Brexit raises so many interesting and topics, right, that we should be discussing. And even if the way in which the Brexit debate has raised them feels extremely destructive in lots of ways, looking back over this 10-year anniversary, there are some things that we could probably point to as welcome debates, or is that too rose-tinted?
Would I say welcome debates? I'm not sure.
Yeah, fair enough.
To be perfectly serious, I do think that there are a few topics, let's say, that have really grown in salience in the last 10 years. And to me, a central one is the question about democracy and to what extent in the UK we have a functioning democracy. And I think this is an issue that goes beyond Brexit, obviously, but Brexit was such a crucial point at which we tested the limits of the democratic system and we found it failing. And I think it continues to fail people quite dramatically. And that is precisely the reason why some of the architects of Brexit continue to profit and to benefit from the chaos that they created. Because in some ways, that chaotic nature of their political project only emphasizes something we all feel deep down to be very true, that we are not in control and that our votes don't count. And we don't really have a meaningful say. And so Brexit did become a very powerful vehicle for that. But I think it's a question that has lingered on, even for people who don't want to talk about Brexit anymore. People will still acknowledge that there is a fundamental rift in our democratic process. And I think the other question for me that has really been crystallized since the referendum, the result, and what happened afterwards is, yes, the kind of the hardening nature of that anti-migrant rhetoric, but also very much the central role that Islamophobia plays in that. And that is something that I think we were, let's say, not ignorant, but a bit more naive about in the run-up to the referendum and immediately afterwards. And I think there was rightly a lot of focus on what will happen to EU citizens, what will happen to various groups, but the fundamental role that Islamophobia plays in keeping these fires going and this growing tension and division in our communities, I think, is something that has grown in importance since Brexit. And I think it still remains a very key issue for us to tackle today. And so I think I would definitely not welcome the fact that it was Brexit that put these two things on the agenda, but I think they're completely unignorable now. And this is not about, this is not about solving Brexit or getting something positive out of Brexit. These are fundamental questions that we as a society need to be able to resolve if we want to be moving forward in any kind of positive way and positive direction. I think we need to fix our democracy, and I think we need to acknowledge the deep-seated and growing role that Islamophobia plays in our politics at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose to rephrase my question in some ways, or rephrase my point, it's not exactly a welcome debate, but it's more that Brexit was a sign of profound dysfunction, that lots and lots of things were breaking at the same time. And in those, in that fracturing, in that series of different breaks and crises happening on top of each other, there is a sort of energy at the same time that's very positive, right? A rethinking and a course of experimentation, from good experiments to very bad experiments, but lots of things become possible that weren't possible previously. And I think that's what makes this moment that we're living through like very polarized in a way, or one minute things are going terribly and the next minute there's great hope, right? That all of that dysfunction going on all of the time. And I wanted to ask you, Kojo, about the question that the issue that I raised in the opening, this slogan, "Take Back Control," that used in the referendum. It was such a powerful slogan, but it was what you could call a bit of an empty signifier, right? For some people, it was about taking back control from Westminster as well as from Brussels, a sense that left behind communities that had experienced Thatcherite deindustrialization just were being failed by this political and economic settlement. For some, it was about immigrants and controlling immigration. But then there's also, I think, this tech oligarchy element that became, I think we saw seeds of it during the Brexit referendum, right? The whole, and especially the investigations afterwards with Cambridge Analytica and stuff. But in the last 2 or 3 years, this has become a really big thing of basically a tech, a US predominantly tech oligarchy saying, in a way, democratic societies will not control us. And that's why we're going to throw our lot in with these far-right extremist elements that aren't interested in controlling us. And in any case, we can just patronize them with massive funding, resources, visibility online. And I feel that Uncommonwealth, you got at that issue, right? That there was a drive to control from the tech oligarchy or the super rich oligarchy. And that's what they meant by that slogan, in a way that they wanted more control for themselves. I just wondered if you could elaborate on that and explain that for us.
Yeah, no, definitely. And the role of this particularly misanthropic and dystopian manifestation of kind of Silicon Valley tech futurism, that's actually a lot of the driving impetus behind the latest book and latest project, even more so than with Uncommonwealth. But I think that it's unsurprising when you sit with the fundamental tension beneath the, at least the Western world at the current moment, which is the drift towards unprecedented levels of inequality and the level of wealth hoarding that we're seeing at the very top end of the Western economy, the Magnificent Seven, your Amazons, your Googles, your Metas, your Nvidias. This is a level of wealth that even makes the Gilded Age, which is obviously the age of American history that Trump romanticizes the most, this makes the robber barons of the Gilded Age, your Rockefellers, your Carnegies, look like just mere peasants in comparison to the amount of wealth and the control of the global economy that's been gained by the tech oligarchy over the last couple of decades. And with that unprecedented inequality occurring in the same moment and connected to the erosion of living standards for day-to-day working people, what began as a decimation of living standards for people on the front lines of manual labor in industrial societies, your miners, your steel workers, your dock workers, that was the first neoliberal transition. And now you're seeing the erosion of living standards for your formerly white-collar professionals, your teachers, all of these. The doctors are on strike every other week because they're saying, as a junior doctor now, in a major metropolitan area, you're not able to survive. You're not able to pay rent, meet your living standards. And so that divergence clearly creates a situation where there is now a driving motivation for the mass majority of people to pass laws that will reorientate the global economy away from the tech oligarchy and towards the people who are struggling with the affordability crisis. And I think there has been a clear commitment, and you couldn't see this clearer with the second Trump administration, where even a number of the Silicon Valley billionaires who seem to be leaning towards a kind of more liberal Obama era climate justice version of the future have now really thrown themselves in with this more nativist authoritarian version of it. And there is a belief that is what is going to be the bulwark against any kind of redistributive politics. And I think you're seeing that clearly. I don't know if Elon Musk could point to where Belfast or where Rotherham is on a map to save his entire family's life. But as soon as anything happens there, he's tweeting about it. He's speaking at the United Kingdom rally. He's throwing his lot in behind Restore and Rupala. And he's doing the same thing with the AfD in Germany and the same thing with a number of other authoritarian right-wing parties across Europe. And I think there has been a clear commitment that the idea of democratic mass politics is a risk towards the continuation of wealth accumulation by the very richest in the world today. And the decision they have made to commit towards authoritarian politics has devastating consequences, I think, for all of us.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Just to link your latest book that we'll talk more about in part two to this chat, you play around with the different meanings of the term fix in the book, right? And so I want to ask you, is Brexit a fix? What do we mean by a fix? Is it a solution or a... And do you think rejoin is inevitable?
Yeah, one thing I found out, or I didn't really sit with until I was writing the new book, which is called The Next Fix, is how much the idea of the word fix is, ironically, one of the most malleable words within the English language. It has so many different meanings, from the idea of fixing something that's broken to the idea of, obviously, in the drugs parlance, to get a fix. But I think one of the things that's really telling is, and in terms of the way that politics is relating towards this oligarchic economic control, is the idea of when we use the word fix in order to talk about like rigging something, fixing a football game, fixing a vote, this idea that there is a predetermined result and that everything else that happens before that, this is pantomime, this is for the show, but the winners and losers have already been decided. Mm-hmm. And was that inevitable with Brexit? I'm not so sure, because I think that even those who threw their entire weight, their financial resources, their political capital behind it, were still surprised that it really worked. I think you could see that in some of their rhetoric. They were like, wow. And it was really one of the very first. We forget that it preceded the success of Donald Trump in his first election, and then everything else we've seen over the subsequent decade. And so I think Brexit was one of the first examples where people realized, with huge resources, that using things like misinformation, using the mimetic viral nature of social media to speak to people's crudest and most base fears could be so successful in redirecting the population away from things that even standard neoliberal experts were going like, this isn't in your interest. And so I don't know if it was predetermined in the way that maybe we might feel a lot of the stuff that's happening now is, but I think it was a real canary in the coal mine for what was going to come later. So yeah, that's what I would answer to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And but in rejoin, inevitable, or not quite strong as inevitable?
I mean, right? I don't know if it's inevitable. I mean, we need to have some politicians who are willing to even make the argument at the moment. I mean, yeah. Almost no one's willing to have that open debate. But I think it's going to be interesting to see what direction the UK goes in over the next 5 years, because, I mean, some of the scenes that we saw over the past month, I think even for somebody as politically cynical and, generally depressed as myself, it was still shocking. You know, it was shocking to see homes being burnt out in Belfast with the idea that, well, maybe there might be a Ugandan nurse who works here, so we've torched the whole house, or, checkpoints being erected on the roads where people were checking the cars to see, the colour of the skin of the drivers. You know, that was happening in a British city in the 21st century. And so the direction the country could go in, I think, is really on a knife edge at the moment. And, I think we have to wait to see what the next few years delivers.
So, Elena, before we say goodbye to you, like, final thoughts. I was just like, what do you think about Rejoin? And I also just wonder, I listened to Kojo and I feel in Another Europe and our like policy work and the wider ecosystems we're in, I feel actually there's a sort of irony in some ways that leftists and progressives are often derided as excessively ideological and not like technocratic enough. But in Kojo's appeal for having politicians that tell the truth, right, and say, actually, look, we've got a series of practical problems here, and how do we go about solving them as a country? Sometimes it feels to me like the activists are the real pragmatists these days. Do you agree? What do you think?
That's an interesting question. I think in some ways, I think we are better at pointing out the problems than opening spaces for solutions in activist spaces. I think there's a lot of work to be done to push people towards this kind of collective imagining. And I think actually just hearing what Kojo was saying about the word fix and holding these multiple meanings, I think there is something there about holding multiple options and multiple directions that the future can go in our spaces and playing with different scenarios that I think activism can offer, I suppose, the general civic space and productive debates about where we're going. I think that's a really useful skill that we should all be cultivating to imagine different futures. In terms of the rejoin question, my short answer would be, depends on what your time scale is. I think maybe rejoin is inevitable, but not immediate. Maybe rejoin is inevitable, but a step towards a much bigger project about transforming global politics. And so it's not an easy fix. And it's not coming immediately after we get a new prime minister. But I think there is an inevitability in it, because I have to believe that collaboration is inevitable and a different way of doing internationalism is inevitable. And what are we rejoining? Maybe something very different from what we left. But I do think that there is space for a collective political project and that Britain will be rejoining that at some point.
Fantastic. On that note, let's take a break here. When we come back, we'll talk more about Kojo's new book, The Next Fix. Kojo, we've been talking around it so far, and it is like strangely relevant in some ways to the Brexit question, right? And the aftermath of empire. So maybe you could just start by telling us like what you're trying to do with the book. And how does the idea of a potential end to the war on drugs, how does that relate to your work on empire? What are the connections and how should we understand them?
Brilliant. No, definitely, Luke. Yeah. You know, it was in some ways a bit of a pivot from my work on Britain and the Aftermath of Empire to write this new book. I will put a copy up so the audience is the next fix. a shameless plug, available at all good bookstores and everyone that's not a good bookstore as well.
But, yeah, it's available everywhere. Exactly. It's not quite yet, I think. It's out in July, right?
No, out in July in the US, but now out in the UK.
It's already out in the UK.
But it's out in the
UK. When you Google these things, it can be a bit confusing.
Google can be misleading for sure. But the point of connection that I think actually ties in to the project on Britain and the Aftermath of Empire was this idea of imperial amnesia that I really tried to advance in Uncommonwealth, the idea that in Britain, we know so little about our colonial past. We know very few countries which were in the empire, the context in which they became independent, how the empire actually ended, when it ended. All of these things are very much erased from the broader public conversation, even though they are leading part of the conversation internationally. And one of the scenes that I actually used to illustrate this in Uncommonwealth was a scene that's in Tony Blair's autobiography where he is under facilitating the handover of Hong Kong back to China. And he talks about how he entered into a conversation with the Chinese premier, where the Chinese premier said, I hope that this return of Hong Kong to British sovereignty will be an end to the kind of long, ugly history between our two countries. And Blair writes in his autobiography, I had no idea what this guy was talking about. Well, history between our two countries. The history the Chinese premier was obviously talking about was the British Opium Wars, which we forget that in the 19th century, Britain fought a war for drugs, for the trade of drugs, not against drugs, in order to force China to accept the opium trade that was at that time being advanced by the major Asian colonial traders, leading, of course, the British East India Company, but then outsourcing it to private smugglers, people like Jardine Matheson Company. You want to talk about the two most successful drug dealers in the history of the world. You probably don't want to talk about Pablo Escobar and El Chapo Guzman. You might want to talk about two Victorian Scottish colonial entrepreneurs called William Jardine and James Matheson, who managed to not only make themselves amongst the richest men in Britain, not only died, not in a hail of bullets like Pablo Escobar, they died members of the Houses of Commons. They also convinced the British Empire to wage a war on behalf of their trade. I don't think Pablo Escobar could have done that. And so when you look at the history of empire in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, you realize that the commercialization of so many substances that in the 20th century we categorized as drugs, the commercialization of opium, the commercialization of coca and its derivatives, the commercialization of cannabis and its derivatives was an essential part of the kind of psychoactive revolution that empire really advanced, which included the commodification of substances that have been mainstreamed in the Western diet, your coffees, your sugars, your tobaccos, your rums. And so the history of these substances is interwoven with the history of empire. The 20th century becomes actually this kind of interregnum on the commercial trade of these substances, where we, through the emergence of the United States, so we can talk a little bit more about how this comes about, their emergence as the global hegemonic power is really tied to their campaign to convince the European empires to give up their colonial monopolies and sign up to this quite remarkable hubristic project of a war on drugs. This idea that if we criminalize and prohibit a set of substances, we will lead to what was promised even in 1998 at a UN meeting, this was the title of it, the creation of a drug-free world. And instead, what we've seen over the 20th century is, despite criminalization, despite prohibition, use of drugs have gone up, the potency of drugs have gone up, drug deaths have gone up, drug addictions have gone up, all the numbers have gone up. And then the most interesting thing, though, for me is really what I trace in the book, is what's happened in the past decade. Almost at exactly the same time that the 2008 financial crisis led to the recognition that kind of the 30-40 year cycle of growth that was tied to neoliberalism, that was tied to what David Harvey calls the spatial fix, the movement of capital into previously uncommodified territories, that came to a close in 2008. And almost at exactly the same time, you started to finally see the laws on previously prohibited drugs start to change, beginning in Colorado and Washington in 2012. And now in 2026, you have all these jurisdictions across the world that have legalized and in some cases commercialized the trade in cannabis most prominently, but also now we're seeing with psychedelics and we're seeing this new emerging growth market. What does that say about the stage of capitalism we're in? What does that say about who are the winners and losers in the future economy? And are we moving back to the future in a way, back to the 19th century, where you had wealthy multinational colonial companies commercializing the trade of these substances? And for me, what I really wanted to try and communicate with the book is, if we are moving into that direction, then now is the time to try and advocate for a different vision of what reform might look like. One that prioritizes social justice, economic justice, different forms of ownership, and trying to repair some of the devastation that the war on drugs visited on some of the most vulnerable people all around the world.
Yeah, and one of the things that you talk about in the book is this commercial, this new commercial capitalism that has sprung up around previously illegal drugs. I think you were invited to a cannabis expo that took place in London, right?
It took place in the city of London, took place right at the heart of financial Britain. And yeah, whilst the UK hasn't legalized recreational cannabis, it has legalized medicinal cannabis. And that has become one of the fastest growing economies in the United Kingdom. Even recently in the Sunday Times list of top 10 fastest growing companies in the United Kingdom, included at number 8 was MAM Medica, a medical cannabis company whose growth was nearly 300% over the past 3 years. And so you are seeing people who've been on London's Tube will probably have started to notice the Curaleaf adverts, and it's always framed in terms of the rebranding of these substances. Now it's wellness treatment. It's, are you suffering with sleep anxiety? Are you suffering with chronic fatigue? There's a new wellness herbal treatment that you can access sometimes online. This is the facilitation of cannabis. And regardless of people's feelings of whether they think cannabis is a positive drug or a negative drug, clearly for some people, this has absolutely transformative medical impact on their physicality. We need to remember, and I track this story in the book, cannabis was legalized medicinally in the UK because of the activism of mothers who had desperately sick children who suffered with complex epilepsy, who were able to get access to medical cannabis in the Netherlands and then put pressure on the government to change the law. And so a lot of these changes, and this happened across all the jurisdictions I went to, were often pushed for social justice means. People who'd been in prison for drugs, people couldn't get access to their medicines because their drugs were prohibited. They pushed for the change. And then who's been the big beneficiaries? Because this change isn't happening in the kind of hippie dream world of the 1960s. Drugs are being legalized, but they're being legalized in the incredibly unequal 21st century. And so a lot of the profiteers have been Silicon Valley-backed biotech companies, the cannabis companies, the very first one recently just floated on the New York Stock Exchange, Trulieve, the Curaleaf, who've been named by Forbes magazine as the largest cannabis company in the world, and their CEO, Boris Jordan, the very first person in the world to have become a billionaire solely through the legal cannabis trade. We're now in this very dystopian world where there are still people being criminalized, being put in prison, in some countries, even facing the firing squad execution for doing exactly the same thing that other people, if you're in the right place, are becoming billionaires for, and that is cultivating and selling a drug like cannabis. And so for me, that says so much about the unequal world that we're moving into, where there are different rules for different people.
Wow, yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I really liked about the book is that you really emphasized that drugs should be seen as part of a chemical revolution in world history, in a way. And the differences between pharmaceutical drugs, for some of the reasons that you've just been explaining, and illegal drugs are not always so straightforward. The famous case of this, of course, is OxyContin in the United States, which basically made the Sackler family into extraordinary billionaires, a failing medical company, by putting heroin, what was in effect heroin, into a pill and encouraging millions of people to take it, to and hacking in a way the extremely flawed, unequal American medical system to enable that to happen. And I thought that was really interesting. And so I was just wanted to pinpoint that a little bit. You also mention in the book the case of Oregon State as pioneering the deregulation and legalization of drugs, but then stepping back from it because they got a real problem with addiction in the state. And that led to quite a nuanced debate, I think, amongst progressives in the United States, some of whom were saying, look, we've been through this experience of mass marketing commercial heroin to vulnerable people, and we know that it's not good. And I just wanted to, yeah, ask you about that, because it's quite a tricky, in some ways, policy issue to get this right. If you have America's public infrastructure or lack of it in healthcare and have that scale of corporate predatory capitalism, it's quite tricky to pursue a delegalization policy that then doesn't have these unintended consequences. And yeah, I was wondering how you would respond to that and what you would say on that issue.
There's so much in those questions. I want to take them kind of one by one. I think, first of all, a little bit of what the book does is dig into the history of how we moved. The drugs that were prohibited in the 20th century have been used by human societies for 5,000 years. You go to the pyramids and you can still see scribes towards the medicinal power of cannabis. And so these have been part of the human story. And so what happens in the early 20th century, where we get this divergence of both simultaneously this commitment to a project of the prohibition of drugs, and also we start taking more drugs than ever before through pharmaceuticals. We move into this new idea of the human species, where we believe that there isn't a human problem that can't be resolved without finding or taking the right drug. Got a headache, take aspirin. You want to build muscles, take steroids. Now, if you want to lose weight, you take GLP-1s or Ozempic. We forget that companies that produce GLP-1s brought in more revenue last year than all the AI companies combined. And so the size of the potential pharmaceutical market for drugs when commercialized is obviously massive. And for me, that really speaks to the kind of world that we're moving into. But we need to, first of all, unpack this idea that there was almost a rational assessment of harm, and drugs that are safe, we commercialize, and drugs that are dangerous, we prohibited. You know, any scientific measurement of harm will blow up that simple dichotomy. Some of the most harmful substances in terms of their impact on human beings, tobacco, alcohol, were obviously heavily commercialized. Some which have now been proven to have medicinal benefits, like cannabis, were heavily prohibited. And when you go back to that early 20th century, so much of the reasons for the demarcation of substances was tied towards a particularly nativist idea of a pure American society being produced, and certain drugs being associated with communities that were seen as an infection almost to the body politic. And one of the crudest examples you can see of that is the way that cannabis is still referred to, even by progressives in America, as marijuana, not realizing that the association of marijuana to the substance was a direct policy decision made by the US government in order to associate its Hispanic name with the emerging migrant communities. And so that's the history. What does that
say? Yeah, interesting.
And you say, yeah, you'll see, you even Democrats, the most progressive Democrat, will be like, we're pushing marijuana legislation. That doesn't get said in the UK. That doesn't get said in Europe. It's always referred to by the plant's name, cannabis, cannabis sativa, cannabis indica, because that doesn't have the same history of its integration with the rhetoric around the demonization of migrant policies. But that's just a little bit of the history. What does that mean about what's going on in the 21st century? For me, I think that this is why it's so important to try and almost use the changes that's happening with drugs, because these changes are happening. Whether people think drugs are bad or drugs are good, we're still debating that in kind of the body politic. But you go into the offices of investment banks, private wealth funds, and you listen to the rhetoric of your Peter Thiels, who backed a psychedelic biotech company with $125 million. You look at Guy Brinden of Google, who backed an Ibogaine company in an investment round. In the corridors of power, they're planning for the world beyond the war on drugs. And that was never made more apparent than two examples in the last year. In December, Donald Trump signed an executive order to reschedule cannabis, surrounded by some leading figures in the cannabis industry. And then even more dramatically, in April of this year, him standing with Joe Rogan, RF Kennedy, and a bunch of military veterans, signed an executive order to fast-track psychedelic medicine all across the United States. If you'd have told Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, when he was sat in that same Oval Office telling America drugs are public enemy number one, that in a generation later, another Republican president would be joking about how wonderful psychedelics are while signing an executive order, he'd have thought that you'd been spiked with some real strong hallucinogenics. But that's the reality of what's happened. And so this change is happening. And for me, if this is simply transferred from being contraband into commodity, as is happening, particularly in the US, then you are going to have a lot of the same systems of predatory capitalism, as you mentioned, now visited upon these, and we have to be honest, still risky products. They carry risk and they carry levels of harm in people who've, anyone who's worked, I've worked, spent a lot of my career outside of academia working in drug treatment services and stuff, will be very aware of. And that in the US now, advertisements, celebrity branding, Instagram adverts for access to now legalized cannabis. That might be one future, but there is also for me a really rare opportunity to almost design a market from scratch and to say, okay, what kind of policies would we put in order to mitigate harm, in order to have a different relationship of consumption and production, in order to have different ownership structures? Might we put restrictions on advertising? Might we do as Germany have done, often actually for restrictions of the European Union law, but they legalized cannabis in 2024, but didn't allow for a commercial retail model. Instead, they legalized the right for people to grow their own cannabis or to form social clubs where people can cultivate that collectively. Is that an example of different forms of consumption and production that could then have lessons for other industries? That for me is part of the most interesting things of talking about this particular area at this particular time.
Yeah, absolutely. And the devil is in the detail in that sense. I was just also wondering and, yeah, wanted to ask you, like, why is the UK, or I don't know, maybe I'm not as like into this issue as you, so maybe it's just my impression, but it feels to me like the UK is like quite behind on this legalization question. We've been clamping down more. We've had the psychoactive substances bill most recently that is a very peculiar bit of legislation that banned all psychoactive drugs and then created some exemptions, right? So the principle was that everything should be banned. So we don't seem to be moving in the same direction as the US. I know you mentioned the Cannabis Expo in London, so there's clearly stuff going on, but I'm not sure, is that doesn't seem to be in the politics, even though we do have a big pharmaceutical sector who I would guess and imagine would be quite interested in making money from a lot of these products and like the medicinals and etc. So I don't know, am I right in thinking that the political debate is just behind the curve of the international debate? I'm thinking in particular of Keir Starmer's quite demagogic attacks on Zach Polanski, saying that he just wants to peddle drugs on the street. Sorry, I say quite demagogic, quite outrageous attacks on Zach Polanski. That's clearly not what he was saying. But why is our debate so backwards compared to this sort of quite forward-looking international discussion?
Yeah, no, I think that we are. We're in a very strange place now in 2026, where the British Labour Party is now markedly to the right of the US Republican Party, the party of the war on drugs, of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan on the issue of drugs. And so we are in an interesting moment changes are happening in Europe. Germany obviously legalized cannabis, Malta, Switzerland, Czech Republic have got a pilot scheme. Switzerland's got a pilot scheme, Czech Republic have gone through the same home grow process. Obviously North America, Canada became the first major nation state in the West after Uruguay to legalize cannabis. The US obviously has half of the states. Now even the Trump administration's moved into that. I think that part of the reasons for the kind of inertia in the UK is our political system. A lot of the stuff we were talking about in the first half of the podcast, changes in the US were often driven from the bottom up. Like I mentioned, it was often public campaigns on social justice that actually changed the law. And then big pharma, big capital moved in order to commodify once that change had happened. And that did happen with the UK, as I mentioned. Now the medicinal market in the UK is absolutely booming, or especially over the past year. And that was a result of social justice changes that opened up the space. And now you're able to set up a medical cannabis company and have direct-to-consumer relationships and see those incredible growths that MedMedica and others have been enjoying over the past couple of years. But I think in order to have the broader debate around changing things like recreational cannabis, psychedelics, or just revisiting the 1971 Misuse of Drugs Act, which is now horrifically out of date. It came in the same year Richard Nixon called for the war on drugs. It hasn't delivered anything it promised. Britain has the largest, or one of the largest, drug death rates in Europe. We have a really brutal problem with vulnerable people dying of substance use. We are very behind on harm reductionist policies that have been the norm in Europe. Things like overdose prevention sites, that was debuted in Switzerland in the 1980s. Not a progressive country, not a radical left country, but just seen as standard public health policy. If you have people with devastating drug dependency, what you want to do is to create an environment that means that they don't die, first of all, and then you start to address their issues and try and support it with mental health stuff, housing, whatever else. That was seen as just normal public health policy on the continent of Europe. We only got our very first drug overdose prevention site in the UK in 2024 in Scotland, which has the highest drug death rate of any major city in Europe. And that was, again, only the result of campaigning of incredible individuals who risked their own life. And again, I tell the story of the person who did that in this book, a gentleman called Peter Crican, who was a long-term heroin user and street worker in Glasgow, who in the midst of the pandemic recognized that Glasgow's already tragic drug death rate was going to explode unless someone did something. He looked at Europe. He knows what works, these overdose prevention sites. And so he set up his own one, was arrested, facing the law, but put the pressure on in order to have that change. And so I think that the changes, or the movement away from the war on drugs, is often a reflection of community organizing and bottom-up political activism. And I think that we in the UK have a system that frustrates that and neuters that much better than a lot of other places. In the US, you have a system of ballot initiatives. So if enough people want something to be voted for, it then goes on the ballot and you can have a mass vote in order to have it, a yes or no. And that's how cannabis legalization happened across the US. We don't have that mechanism in the UK. So we need politicians to push for it. And when the Green Party tried to push for it, like you mentioned, everybody, including the Labour Party, said all they want to do is give heroin to children, which is, of course, preposterous. So yeah, I think that those are some of the limitations in the UK, but I do think we're starting to move into a situation in which the UK is really looking like piggy in the middle. There's changes happening on the continent of Europe, there's changes happening in North America, and there's only so long I think the UK can continue to ignore this conversation. But the conversation has to be made front and center, and we need people, politicians, political actors to make that point and have the courage to say, we know this doesn't work. We know we're not moving into a drug-free world. We know that our criminalization has led to the highest drug death rates in Europe, overcrowded prisons. We're constantly complaining about our prisons being overcrowded. The MOJ says 15% of all prisoners are there for drug offences, non-violent drug offences. And we need people to connect it to other issues, connected to issues like wealth inequality, connected to issues like politics, connected to issues like the constitutional debt that the UK has in terms of actually being able to have a functioning democratic politics. And so I think if we have so often in the UK, drug policy reform is seen as a niche issue and something that's only relevant to like maybe a couple of hippies and a couple of people who might have been at the rave a bit too long. But I think what I'm trying to do with this book is show how it connects to real substantive issues of material, political and economic substance. And I think that is going to help push the conversation forward in the UK.
Oh, fantastic. I could listen to you all day, KJ, obviously. And that's been so interesting. We are out of time. I would say there's a lot in the book that we haven't covered, but that's just an appeal to everyone to go out and buy it and read it yourself. I think Kojo has intimated this on a couple of occasions, but I just want to emphasize it. The book is really good at bringing out the personal stories and really bringing the characters in this transformation to life. And that makes it a brilliant read and why everyone should read it, and also then connects it to these massive global issues. I think in particular, Kojo, in terms of what you've just said, you've drawn like a really strong link to the first part of the discussion too, because on drugs policy and on Brexit, we're appealing for evidence-based public interest politics. And this is the progressive left, the radical left, the social justice-oriented left. They're actually saying, look, why don't we look at the evidence? Why don't we look at the policy? Why don't we look at what works? And we know that this is complicated, and we know that you have to get, there are trade-offs and you have to balance things, and maybe, and mistakes might be made in the whole process too. And we'll have to learn from those mistakes, but we have to do something to change this situation. But thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having me, Luke. And yeah, really real pleasure to be back. Great love for the work you guys are doing. And hopefully we can speak more again in the future.
Right. So that's all we've got time for today. I hope you've enjoyed it. The Counterpower podcast is produced by Another Europe is Possible, Global Justice Now and Stop Trump Coalition. Our aim is to bring together experts and activists to talk about global justice and inspire you, our audience, into action. So if you don't know our networks and organizations, do look us up. Get involved. There's lots to do. And remember, you can support Counterpower by finding the crowdfunder in the show notes. And whatever you do, don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow Counterpower. Maybe even leave us a nice review. We'll see you again soon.